This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Is there an increase in people engaging in binge behaviors due to the pandemic? And are we going to see things like overindulging in alcohol as something that will continue once we get out of this situation? Some experts have predicted the aftermath of COVID-19 could mirror the roaring 20s. With us now, we have Melissa Siders, Associate Professor of Psychology at IUPUI, to talk more about alcohol consumption and what we're seeing right now. Welcome, Melissa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start first and understand a little bit about what you do in studying alcohol consumption.
Yes, so I'm an associate professor at IUPUI, and I'm really interested in predictors of and things that foster more risky levels of alcohol use disorder in anyone from, you know, kind of just normal, typical social drinkers all the way up through people who might suffer from alcohol or substance use disorders.
And so what have you been seeing with this pandemic? Has it shifted some of the way you've been studying this at all?
Absolutely. You know, when we started our explorations into how COVID might be affecting alcohol use really early on in the pandemic, within the first month of the pandemic, we saw a lot of things in the media like quarantinis and Zoom happy hours. And it made us really wonder if we were going to see large increases in risky types of alcohol consumption. And so we started to ask people these questions, and we started with a U.S. nationwide survey of adults that we conducted online since, you know, much of in-face research was shut down at the beginning of the pandemic. And what we found is that contrary to what people were thinking, we actually saw drops in alcohol use during that first month of the pandemic, likely driven by people drinking less in social contexts, less access to bars and restaurants and things of that nature. But there was a small subgroup of people who showed large increases in their alcohol consumption. And these were the people who were already risky or heavy drinkers before the pandemic started. And it was likely driven by drinking in response to coping with the stress mm-hmm. or the worry about the pandemic. And so more kind of drinking at home, self-medication, if you will, and trying to cope with this new normal that we were experiencing at that time. So it was really the people that we would have been worried about before the pandemic who were showing greater escalations in drinking in that first period of the most stringent and strict changes of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the pandemic was more of a trigger for folks that were already at risk to be overindulging or going into sort of the addiction category.
Yes, absolutely. And many of the people in our sample said, I'm drinking a lot less because I'm not going out, you know, things like that. But the people who were already kind of using that the alcohol for maybe self-medication purposes or in more risky or harmful ways continued to escalate that. And that made us really concerned for the long-term effects as the pandemic progressed.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting is hearing that for folks who are social drinkers, they were able to just kind of tone it down because they didn't really have an outlet. I wonder, you know, so these online things didn't get people more excited to join in with their friends. I find that kind of interesting. Maybe it's just like that screen isn't the same as like being next to someone.
I absolutely think that's true. You know, when you think about going out to a bar or a restaurant setting, it's a lot different than sitting here on a Zoom or a Google Meet. And it kind of doesn't foster the same type of overindulgence that you might have face to face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just thinking of the social gatherings I've had with friends. I don't drink, but, you know, nobody would know, right? I'm just like, I have my glass here of something, you know, I can pretend.
Absolutely.
So what are you studying with this sort of subgroup of the people in the pandemic? I mean, are there certain age groups you're looking at? Is there anything that you're really narrowing down with this?
Well, interestingly, we had a study that had started prior to the pandemic, and it was people who are reportedly in recovery from alcohol or substance use disorders. So we started that study well before the pandemic began, which, of course, got interrupted with the onset of the pandemic. But it gave us a wonderful opportunity to understand how people who have diagnosed substance or alcohol use disorders might be coping during this time. Interestingly, when we talked to people during that first 6 weeks of the pandemic, the time where lots of things were shutting down, it was harder to get access to treatment, our people in recovery were experiencing a lot of hardships at that time, just like many other people were. they were reporting things like their treatment centers completely shutting down, having to move out of transitional housing, and not having the routines and the structures that had been so critical to their recovery up to that time. Saying things like, you know, my recovery is all built on going to meetings and going to groups and talking with others, and all of that has been disrupted by the pandemic. So this was a group we were really concerned about. Interestingly enough, we didn't have a lot of reinitiation or of use or what might think of as a relapse during that time. Our folks, in addition to reporting increased stress or worry and barriers to treatment during that time, talked about these wonderful coping strategies that their treatment centers had prepared them for. One person said something along the lines of, my treatment center has well prepared me to deal with the stresses of this pandemic. You know, engaging in things like self-care, connecting with other people through online mechanisms, and to some extent, having everything shut down be a barrier to using again, right? You know, they're not in the environment where they might have access to drugs or alcohol. So being at home was somewhat protective for some of these folks. So we felt kind of relieved that although they were experiencing massive barriers to treatment and were expressing a lot of the stress and worry that many of us were during that time, that they were well equipped to cope and to remain abstinent during this, you know, unprecedented time that we were all experiencing.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting too is we spoke with someone last week, I think it was, who was recovering, I'm trying to think of the terminology, recovering from an opioid addiction from many, many years ago. And he had mentioned that for some folks that this was such an isolating time that it was like making them want to use more. And I guess it's just always interesting to think about it in the way that, like, you would assume that the less people you're around, the less temptation there is. But it seems like perhaps it depends on whatever the substance is. Like, you know, if alcohol is something that you would partake in heavily with people, now you're kind of protected in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And much of substance use is a secretive, individual thing, right? And so if you're left alone to your own devices, it can be a very dangerous time for some folks. We found in our study of people in recovery that people who felt socially isolated were the ones at greatest risk for things like depression and anxiety and increased substance cravings during this time. So those who were able to get some sort of social support or engagement during this time were faring much better than other people.
Mm-hmm. And what are you seeing with students and people that are kind of in this hybrid situation of going to campus and being at home? Is there a change in sort of their behavior? Is it like it was before, or is there an increase in them consuming alcohol?
Well, it's hard to say. I think there's a lot of folks who, again, are just, you know, they don't have the access to it like they used to. They're not going to the kegger parties. They're not going to the Greek life parties. They might not have access to house parties in the way that they were used to. And so the access is highly restricted. However, I wonder, as the pandemic progresses and things are changing and now we're entering the summer with vaccines being available much more widely, that it's very likely that we'll see an increase of alcohol use in response to celebrating this new, you know, reemergence into our lives. So I worry some about raising alcohol use rates sort of as a celebratory mechanism here as we move forward, especially in young people.
Right. And I wonder also with young people, were they partaking more because it felt so much more taboo and, you know, in lockdown, you're not supposed to be gathering and doing this. So maybe it's more enticing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's probably some of that happening as well, although I imagine that some risk has been reduced, but there might be kind of a swing back in the opposite direction now as things are opening back up. So it just reminds us all to be, you know, careful about how we're using and making sure that we're using in ways that it won't be harmful to us down the road.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like in the research that you've done, do you see that some of this stems from high impulses to just do things, or is that kind of a stereotype? You know, people say, well, if you can't control your impulses, you need to work on that.
Yeah, so my main interest in looking at alcohol and substance use disorders is in the integration of how impulsivity or impulsive personality combines with emotional responding. So you can imagine, you know, emotions have run high, high and low over the last year. And we find that, you know, people might drink very frequently. You know, they might have a drink every night with dinner or drink kind of frequently during the week. And that's not necessarily a risky drinking pattern, right? You can have one or two drinks and be relatively healthy over time, you know, even more healthy in some cases. But the types of alcohol use that we find particularly problematic are more of the binge patterns, you know, drinking not just two, but four, eight, 10, 12 drinks at a time lead to a slew of different health and wellness concerns for individuals. And those types of drinking patterns are highly related to this sort of impulsive responding in the context of really high positive or really high negative emotional states. And when we've looked at a slew of different types of type of alcohol or substance use disorders, as well as other mental struggles that people might be having, this combinations of emotions and impulsive behavior really make a perfect storm for more risky patterns of maladaptive behaviors over time.
And so we've kind of talked about all of these different sort of avenues with binging and alcohol consumption and the pandemic and all that. What are some of the solutions or, I guess, resources people can turn to?
Yes, there are many community resources that are out there. There's great support groups that are involved for people who just want to learn more about their alcohol or substance use or have peer supports to do that. And I always recommend people trying multiple different types of groups. Just like there's multiple different types of churches, there are multiple different types of groups, and finding one for you that really feels good and sticks is the important part. I think that when we think about alcohol and substance use, when we find ourselves drinking in order to respond to emotional states, that's when we should just check ourselves. It doesn't necessarily mean it's all bad, but it has the potential probably to result in alcohol consumption that might be in violation of or higher than we initially planned to do. And when those rates get really high, you know, we're talking 4, 5, 6, 8 plus drinks, we put ourselves in a position that could really cause us some harm.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your insight and your research. We really appreciate having you on. Melissa Siders, Associate Professor of Psychology at IUPUI. We'll be back after a quick break when we shift gears to other binge behaviors Hoosiers experienced during the pandemic. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before the break, we discussed the impact of the pandemic on alcohol consumption. And as we continue to look at how binge behaviors have been affected by the COVID-19 crisis, how has it affected our spending habits? With us now is Rick Wilk, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Anthropology, specializing in consumer culture at IU Bloomington. Welcome to the program, Rick.
It's a pleasure to be here, Miriam.
Well, let's get started with what you do as an anthropologist. How did you become an expert on consumer culture?
Well, I've been doing ethnographic research in the country of Belize for about 45 years now. And in writing a book about the history of the country and its involvement in globalization, I got intrigued by the early settlers of the area, who were mostly pirates and buccaneers. And they had a ferocious binge culture kind of built into their way of life. They would essentially spend months and months at a time eating kind of salted rations and having nothing to drink while they kind of wended their way around the Caribbean. A lot of them ended up doing really hard manual labor. And at the end of a voyage, they'd end up in one of these pirate ports, like Port Royal in Jamaica. And suddenly they'd have a huge bunch of cash that was settled on them. And they would set about spending it as quickly as possible. And they were famous for kind of drinking and carousing and buying expensive trinkets and then ending up a few weeks later lying in a gutter somewhere, unconscious and indebted and ready to hit the high seas again. And I kind of traced that pattern through the military, early full-time armies and navies, and all kinds of all-male working groups, loggers and gold miners. They all had a very similar way of spending months and months and months in isolation and working really, really hard and then getting paid off at the end and just splurging like crazy until they were broke and had to go back and start all over again.
So they didn't understand the concept of savings, it sounds like.
Well, you know, they were uneducated and poor and generally treated like the dregs of society. And they kind of treated women as what they called Navy wives, someone you would kind of hang around with and who would soak up all your money. And then as soon as you were broke, kick you out the front door and send you back to work. So there was a lot of, you know, bad gender relations worked into this binging way of life. It's actually one of the things that got prohibition started in the USA. It started as the Anti-Saloon League, and the idea was to get men away from spending their afternoons and nights over in the bar, hanging out and drinking and eating with their buddies and then coming home broke.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's this whole history of that that seems to date very, very far back. How does that compare to what we're currently going through? Is this pattern constantly at play?
Well, you know, if you look at the average person's workday, you have a whole cycle of these kind of, let's work hard and then we'll take a coffee break. You know, let's work hard and then we'll go out for lunch. Then we'll work all afternoon, we'll go home and relax, you know, and we'll work all week and then we'll have a weekend to relax and take it easy. And then, you know, we'll work for a year and then we'll get a couple of weeks of vacation where we can just, you know, drink and do whatever we like, go on a cruise, have fun. So I think we still have that kind of control and release built into the way that we consume in American society and pretty much all over the world where you have consumer culture. You can even think about it as your whole life. You know, you work really hard and then you get to retire and take it easy. And that's kind of your reward for working so hard for so long.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a way to change that. I mean, when I think about that, and there are some other nations sometimes that they'll bring up where, like, you know, the working environment is so much more laid back. People look at Americans like, you guys work way too hard. You know, like, what? Why are we doing this to ourselves?
That's like the $64,000 question. since I retired a couple of years ago, I've been trying to figure it out because after I retired, I'm still working. You know, I think that that kind of rhythm of your life gets into you at a really fundamental level. And a lot of us kind of find it hard to relax and hard to let go. And I think that's one reason people have resort to alcohol and recreational drugs. It's because, you know, it incapacitates you. You can't work when you're totally out of it. And yeah. So it kind of relieves you, the drug relieves you of the responsibility.
Right.
And, you know, I studied food and eating behavior with IU students for the last few years before I retired. And I found out they were involved in this kind of thing every day. You know, where they'd say things like, Well, I went and I worked out at the rec center this morning, and I think I earned about 1,800 calories. So I can go out and have pizza for dinner tonight. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, you've worked hard and you've accomplished something. I even had a student in one of my interviews. He once said, well, it's your fault. If you guys wouldn't assign all this work, we wouldn't have to go partying on the weekend. So like making people work hard and really put in a lot of effort, it gives people a sense that they deserve something as a reward. We call this moral balancing. And it turns out that it's something we pretty much all do.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like you want to feel like you deserve it. You reward yourself. It's an incentive. But I guess sometimes it goes too far. Instead of just doing work for the sake of doing work, it's like, but I have to have a reason. I have to have a reward at the end.
Yeah, it's like you deserve a break today. and you can see this with little kids. One of my favorite expressions that people use in Belize is, you know, when kids get out of school where they've been forced to sit down for hours and hours and pay attention, they have this tendency to just go wild. They burst out of the school and kind of run around with all this energy. And the expression is like Lego beast, like a let go beast, you know, something wild that has been in captivity and then just gets let go and has to go wild. And, you know, to some extent, I think we all feel that impulse at a certain point that, wow, I just really need to get out of here. And I think the pandemic has just changed people's sense of time dramatically and built up this kind of long period of being good and, you know, staying at home and doing all kinds of chores that you used to be able to escape from. Mm-hmm. You know, even people like me who love to cook, about 2 or 3 months into the pandemic, I was ready to kind of stop cooking for a while. It started to turn from being a pleasure into a kind of burden and a duty. And, mm-hmm. you know, so when we're forced to do things, it really has an effect on our ability to relax and our needs for relaxation and recreation. So I just worry that after the pandemic, after people get their shots and they start to feel entitled, that they're really going to, you know, the cruise ships are going to fill up and holiday makers are going to be going wild in Las Vegas. And not that that's a bad thing, but that, as you said, people have a tendency to go overboard sometimes, like spring break.
Right. Yeah, well, spring break, what is that? I don't know what that is anymore. But you know, what I'm wondering, you know, as you mentioned the pandemic and stuff, and the different types of sort of these behaviors that are coming out in the binging, you know, when it comes to spending, are people now, because they've been holding on so long and maybe they've been saving up or maybe they've been online shopping the whole time, but are people going to be spending more once quote unquote the lockdown lifts or whatever?
You know, again, that's a question that hundreds of thousands of economists are making their predictions right now about what's going to happen and whether it's going to be like the baby boom generation, which came after all that restriction on people's behavior and rationing during World War II and the separation of men and women that took place so widely. And really, you know, the 1950s were the golden age of consumer culture in America. So I have a feeling that we are going to see a period of just incredible growth right after the the pandemic has really ended in this country. Some of that's going to be great, you know, lots of jobs for people. As someone who's kind of follows climate science pretty closely, I also worry that people are going to be going out and buying unnecessary things that use lots of fossil fuels. So I recently did a project on the carbon impact of billionaires. And, you know, some billionaires these days are living on their 500-foot yachts. And they're emitting like 1,000 times more carbon than you or me every day, because they've got their servants and their entourage and their, you know, hangers-on and submarines and helicopters and just all of their toys emitting carbon dioxide that we all have to cope with. So I, you know, I'm kind of hoping that when we rebuild America better, that it's really going to be better. And that a lot of those new jobs are going to be in areas that are better for us and better for the planet, maybe a little bit less destructive.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, for example, with sort of online versus in-person shopping, if people are going to be so sick of shopping online that it's going to switch and people are going to start going to stores again.
Oh, I went to Kroger the other day. It was like, oh my God, I can actually pick my own vegetables.
and get the good ones, right?
Yes, exactly. Not the ones that somebody anonymously picked for me. But it was also kind of weird because I've kind of gotten used to having stuff delivered. And I think a lot of us aren't good to go back to the way we lived before before the lockdown. And some of those habits might be, you know, I'm used to, at this point, just looking up Amazon every time I want something. Mm-hmm. And maybe
not that we're advertising for them.
No. But but my daughter would be angry at me for even mentioning the name. But you know, I think we get lazy and slothful sometimes and get into bad habits, like instant gratification. And there's something to be said for kind of working hard and putting things off. And kind of thinking carefully about where you spend your money and what you're saving. I know it makes me sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but, you know, it's one of the privileges of getting old, one of the few good things about getting old.
Yeah, you can share your wisdom with us for sure. But, you know, what I'm wondering, you mentioned, like, these billionaires and you know, they've got all of these toys and they're out there, I guess, still during the pandemic, I'm presuming. But how do their spending habits compare to other people? Is this something that is common in everyone, this sort of consumer culture, these spending habits, these just going it all out, regardless of your income status?
Well, there's about 2,500 billionaires on the Forbes list. And then there's another 300,000 people who are called ultra high wealth individuals. And unfortunately, I think, you know, they provide a bad example for all of us. I wouldn't say, you know, they got private jets and private helicopters and they're far above us. But in some way, I think the lifestyles of the rich and famous are still very attractive. So it's really nice to see celebrities and people. I mean, Elon Musk is not my favorite person on the planet by any means, but among billionaires, he's been a pretty good example, selling his houses and giving up a lot of his properties and promising to travel less and burn less fossil fuel. I think that's an example that we could all kind of think about as maybe better than the fat cats living on their yachts.
Mm-hmm. Well, real quick, as we get ready to head out, what are your predictions for what's going to happen once this pandemic subsides, whether it's a year or 5 years from now, in terms of consumer culture?
You know, I've seen so much diversification during the and creativity coming out of young people on the web and on sites like Etsy. So I think mass culture is getting customized, and people are much more interested in things that are unique and creative rather than just the same stuff everybody else is buying and wearing. And I hope that that trend's really going to continue. Because it provides work, it provides creativity. It's a kind of flowering of arts, and I really hope to see that continue.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, Rick Wilk, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Anthropology, specializing in consumer culture at IU Bloomington. We'll be back after a quick break. When we return, we'll talk to a retired professional wrestler about Indiana's history and the sport on the cusp of WrestleMania weekend. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Professional wrestling may not be the first thing you think of when it comes to Indiana, but there have been quite a few people who've made a successful career who trace their start to the Hoosier State. With us now to talk about his personal journey as a wrestler and give us some insight into WrestleMania, we have Billy Logsdon, a retired professional wrestler who is based out of Lafayette, Indiana. For some reason, I can't say the word wrestler today, but welcome, Billy, to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
I want to start that. I want to ask you real quick, what does it mean to be a retired wrestler? Like, what does that entail to retire?
It's at a certain point as a professional wrestler, you only have so much of a lifespan that your body can hold up. And some people's is shorter than others. When it comes to professional wrestling, also, it's no different when you're starting out. It's no different than like a comedian or a musician, right? So a comedian or a musician, they get their start in dive bars, and professional wrestlers usually get their start in like bingo halls or armories or any place that can put a 16 by 16 ring up. You work your way up, and then basically you spend a lot of those years getting beat up, and then finally you hope to get your big break. You hopefully somebody notices you, and you actually can start signing the contract and making a lot of money doing it. For me, I never got to the big time level. I was able to make enough money to travel, but just on an independent level. So after I'd reached my age limit and my daughter started getting to a certain age, that's when I decided that it was probably time for me to retire.
What was it that got you into wrestling in the first place?
So as a kid, I grew up on the gravel roads of Lafayette, Indiana. So we only had growing up, I only had three or four channels, and I happened to be flipping through the channels one day and wrestling was on TV. And, I actually remember I just was flipping through them, and all of a sudden I seen somebody being interviewed, and they walked outside of a building, and then they started beating up some random person down the street. And I thought it was like the greatest thing ever. So that got me hooked. And then my dad, he started buying me wrestling magazines, which opened up my a whole new world of what was actually out there all over the world. And so he was always very supportive of me and that that hobby that I had for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Now, for our listeners, I think we need to clarify. Are there two types of wrestling? There's the wrestling that you see in college sports, and then there's this professional wrestling circuit. What is the difference, and what are the similarities?
So the amateur style wrestling, Olympic style that many people know of, that is it's. I don't want to say the words it's real compared to what we do, which is more choreographed, but that is the big difference. There's a big competition there with the there's not a predetermined winner like there is in my sport. So ours is a lot of theatrics. Nowadays I can open up a little bit more and say that back in the old days of Dick the Bruiser, who's an Indiana native, I would have gotten beat up for saying that out loud. But in this day and age, anybody can literally go on Google and find out anything they want about professional wrestling. So.
Mm-hmm. You're reminding me, I think the first episode, The Rock has a new sitcom. And the first episode, somebody was like, it's not real. And they were going to like beat up the kid for saying that.
Yes. Yeah. Andre the Giant got in his face and said, don't ever use the F word. So it's definitely not, I don't like the word fake myself. I have a lot of injuries from professional wrestling. The slaps you see, those are very real. A lot of the bleeding's real. So there's a lot to it, just the wear and tear. The ring itself is only made out of plywood and steel, and there's a little bit of padding. So there's give. Some rings, let me repeat that. Some rings have a give. Some are very solid. So there's a lot of wear and tear on a person's body.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you almost have to pay your dues at smaller rings and really get injured before you get into the big leagues where maybe it's a little more cushy.
Kind of, yeah. The higher the promotion, probably the nicer the ring is. So, like I said, a lot of these smaller promotions, they probably use cheap rings. They use what they could afford, and sometimes those rings are really old and beat up. So,
So what kept you going when you first got into wrestling? What made you want to keep going when it sounds like it's pretty physically taxing?
Just my love for it. I was very passionate about it. I just couldn't get enough of it. And that's what got me going. And for me, breaking in, I'm only 5'5", and at the time I broke in was 140 pounds. So that was incredibly small for a pro wrestler. I eventually was able to pack on 20 pounds of muscle, but still, I couldn't grow anymore. So that was also one of the reasons why I didn't really – probably ever make it to the WWE. It's because I was my size. It's just like any other, like I said, like a comedian trying to break in, just like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am a comedian, so I do understand that aspect. It is tough. You know, you have to pave your way somehow by paying your dues. Well, maybe you don't always have to. Maybe sometimes there's someone and it's the right time and the right place. But, you know, when it comes to your career as a wrestler, were there any like signature moves that you had? Or I don't know. I'm just curious because it always seems like each wrestler has something that they're known for.
For me, I did have signature moves, but I had more of a signature style, and it was basically catch as catch can wrestling. And it's almost like a human chess game. So when I'd wrestle my opponents, it would always be me trying to do some sort of trickery, that normal wrestlers don't do. So I would, for example, I would do stuff where I would, jump off the second rope and slide between their legs. They didn't know where I was at, turn around, and I'd hit them with a drop kick or something, like just trickery type stuff like that. But it's like a human chess game rather than the big physical beating each other up type style. But some of my cooler moves that I did are signature moves. I did a move, which is hard to explain. It's hard to explain here on this, but we called it sliced bread number two. It was just some name some wrestler called it. And basically it was just me grabbing them by the head, and I basically did a backflip, and they would fall on their back, and I would land on my stomach, and that was the move. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. That's pretty intense. That sounds like a pretty intense flip. Well, we have WrestleMania coming up. What exactly is it? We teased a little bit about this. What is it, and what does it mean for fans?
So it is the Super Bowl. Well, many people will call it too as the Super Bowl of professional wrestling. So believe it or not, WrestleMania back, you know, pre-COVID, would draw anywhere between 80 and 90,000 people in a large stadium. So imagine that many people to watch in WWE, it's a 20 by 20 ring, still very small in comparison to a large stadium. People will come around all over the world to watch this event. There'll be millions of people that'll watch it. This year it'll be on the Peacock network, but it used to be pay-per-view. So it's a pretty big deal in the world of professional wrestling.
And has it been affected by COVID at all? Is there actually going to be an audience?
There is this year. Last year was rough. So they literally, the whole like shutting everything down happened about 3 weeks before WrestleMania. So they ended up having it, but it was in front of no fans. And it's to me as a fan, the matches were great, but it's that whole atmosphere of having a live audience there too, that makes the show big. And so this year they are opening it up to 25,000 people. So there will be a crowd there. So I'm interested in to see how this will turn out for them.
Yeah. I think it's been interesting for a lot of sort of live performance events where you feed off of the crowd's energy. When there isn't a crowd there, does it show whether you're actually that good or not? If you can't do anything unless there's a crowd, I just wonder sometimes how that balances out.
Absolutely. You're a comedian. So imagine doing jokes in front of an empty room and just hoping somebody sees you on TV or something. It would be awkward.
Right. So. Although I joke, you know, I'm used to talking to myself in radio, so I'm used to having no audience. It's all good for me. So you also worked as a trainer in Lafayette. You were training wrestlers. What was that like? As opposed to being a wrestler?
I loved it. I love teaching people who have the same passion for professional wrestling as I do. It was such a rewarding experience. In fact, with your bringing up WrestleMania, I actually have a student who did get signed with the WWE. She's actually going to be wrestling this weekend. It was just announced last week. So I'm really excited for her. She's been a part of WrestleMania's before, but only on like the pre-show. And this year she's actually on the main show. So I'm really excited for her to get that experience.
And that's a student that's from Indiana that's made it all the
way
up there.
Yep. Yeah. I apologize. Yeah. It's her name is Ruby Riott, and she grew up in the Northern Indiana area. She trained with me, and in honor of me, she actually, when they announced her, Ruby Riott, the announcer from Lafayette, Indiana, and that's in tribute to me. So I'm honored every time I get to hear that.
Well, that's cool. And so, you know, you've trained these students to go off into the big time. I mean, is this something you're still doing or have you retired from that as well?
Very rarely. It just happens I am wrestling this weekend in Lafayette, Indiana, at the We All Rec Center. But I very rarely, I'm just doing this as a favor. Unfortunately, it's for circumstances where a former wrestler I know had passed away. So they're doing a tribute show for him. So I'm wrestling one of my other students this Saturday.
What kind of a background do you need to have to be in professional wrestling? Do you need to have a gymnastics background mixed with weightlifting? I'm just making a guess here.
No, that's a fantastic question. In my opinion, you definitely need to be somewhat of an athlete. That's not always guaranteed that you even need that. Definitely a lot of charisma. If you can't wrestle, then if you have charisma, they can still make money off of you. So the total package is somebody who is an athlete who can jump around or fly around the ring and just has a, as you mentioned, The Rock, a personality like Dwayne Johnson. That's basically what I always looked for in wrestlers. But definitely you want to have one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Do you think wrestling is continuing to be a sport or even a performance that people are paying attention to? I just wonder, because I'm thinking about when I was growing up, like it was a big deal. You'd see it on TV, you'd see those magazines, and now you don't really hear so much about it.
I do. Actually, it's I know, like I said, I always use WrestleMania as kind of the measuring stick. So if WrestleMania, like I said, pre-COVID drew 25,000 people, then I would say you're worried. But every year it's still drawing 80, 90,000 people. And for me, there's now other wrestling promotions starting to pop up that are competing with the WWE. So I do think it's big. I know somebody recently brought up to my attention, and they're somewhat right. I think in today we have so many ways for regular fans to talk with celebrities. So you have Twitter, you have social media. Now you can order them on, you can get them to talk to you on Cameo and stuff. And I think sometimes that kind of takes away from the mystique of seeing a celebrity, right? So if I saw Andre the Giant back when I was a kid, my mind would be blown. But if he was still alive, I could just talk to him on Cameo now, right? So I think sometimes that kind of affects just any type of celebrity type status.
Yeah, that makes me think if there are any wrestlers, pro wrestlers that just aren't on social media to keep up that mystery.
I believe there'd be a few, and they would probably be for the WWE, but I guarantee every independent wrestler I know is trying to get their name out there, so they're all over the place there.
Yeah. Yeah, I see it in every profession. You know, people feel like they have to be on these platforms. So now that you're not wrestling anymore, do you ever feel like, I know you said you're doing this benefit coming up, but do you ever feel like you want to go back? Can you go back? Or is it like once you say you're retired, you can't?
Oh, no, I can. There's a wrestler named Terry Funk that's probably retired about 50 times in his career. So I can come back. It's just like right now, my life, my daughter is does travel softball. She just made the middle school team, so she's doing very well there. So I always joke around that I went from being a traveling pro wrestler to now a traveling softball dad. So just my life where I'm at, I won't come back ever full time, nor will my being 44, my body could hold up to the stress and the demands of pro wrestling.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about wrestling that you're still involved till this day that, you know, you're not just stepping away completely?
Young wrestlers can always message me on social media, Twitter. I'm under as Billy Rock. They can always message me. They'll send me matches to critique. I still watch wrestling with my daughter, and I still have a lot of students who are attached to pro wrestling that I still am in contact with. A lot of people that I used to wrestle against, say Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, or John Moxley now, they now wrestle on TV every weekend. So, there's that attachment. It's pretty neat for me. Like I said, it's no different than, you know, you're doing a comedy show and, a famous comedian you don't know at the time becomes a famous comedian later on. You're like, oh yeah, we used to be in the comedy clubs together. It's the exact same thing. They were just lucky enough and fortunate enough to get that a big deal in pro wrestling.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts with WrestleMania coming up? Anything you're super excited about? I know you have your former student performing. Anything else?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to a couple matches. One is Seth Rollins versus a guy by the name of Cesaro, two guys that I used to wrestle with on the independents. I'm really looking forward to that match. And then there's a wrestler who is retired because of a neck injury 10 years ago. He's now back. So his name's Edge. So I'm looking forward to watching his match against Roman Reigns and Daniel Bryan. So those are the couple matches I'm interested in.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Billy Logsdon is a retired professional wrestler based out of Lafayette, Indiana. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Join us tomorrow as we explore the topic of life expectancy. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.